I want to ask you a question. It's the most important question I believe I could ever ask anybody. By the way, if you've got a bulletin, there's an outline in the bulletin. As you recall, when I was preaching here, I did that. And if you look in your bulletin, you'll find that outline. The blanks will be filled in as we go along. And Bob has been good enough to help me with that. But I'm going to ask you a question that is probably the most important question you could ever be asked, and it's also the most important question that you'll ever answer in your life. And that question is this: what is your perception of God? That's an important question for you as an individual. You have to answer that. You must answer that. It's also the most important question that the church has to answer. And the church has to answer that question. What is our perception of God? You see, how we view God determines two things. First of all, it determines how we live. Your perception of God is going to determine how you look at life and how you live life. If you have a low opinion of God, then your life is probably going to be a kind of life that is pretty much doing whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it, being involved in whatever things you want to be involved in. The second thing that it determines is how we worship. How you worship. Because if you have a low opinion of God, then your worship is going to indicate that. In fact, I will go so far as to say, tell me what your perception of God is, and I will tell you what your spiritual life is going to be now and in the future. Because your perception of God determines both of those two matters in your life. Perception of God has changed dramatically. You look at the world. And frankly, if you look at how the world is and how they perceive God, you have to ask the question, where did you find that God? Where did you find a God that does whatever you want to do, comes only when you're ready for Him, and will never bother you when you're involved in whatever it is you want to be involved in? Where did you find that God at? When you look at the moral degradation of our nation, and that gives you some insights into exactly what people think of God. What is in the world tends to seep into the church. I don't like that. I wish it was different, but that's just the way life is. Whatever is in the world is going to find its way into the church. And the reason it is, because we are all in the world. And when we come into the church, when we come into Christ Jesus, we tend to drag some of those thoughts, those behaviors, and those belief systems with us, as well as those value systems. Let me also say this. A diminished view of God is the very source of idolatry. Idolatry is treating God in a way or creating God in a way that is not like the God of the Scriptures. Turn with me to Romans chapter 1 for a moment. In Romans chapter 1, we begin reading at verse 18. The passage is probably not too unfamiliar to you. He says, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." I want you to notice this verse, verse 21. "For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God, nor gave thanks. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. And although they claimed to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles." Idolatry begins in the mind. And when you have a low view of God, you have just created a God in an image that is not biblical. There is nothing that God hates more than idolatry. He said through the prophets, "I will share my glory with no other." Israel went into Babylonian captivity and to Assyrian captivity. And one of the main reasons they did was because of idolatry. Idolatry was rampant in Israel. After the Babylonian captivity, we find that idolatry never again came into the community of the Jewish people. When we bring God down to a level that we can understand and cope with, we have created God in an image of our own making. What the world thinks of God is atrocious. But also, we find that what the world considers right and wrong has a way of making its way into the church as well. It is imperative that we focus attention upon the God that we worship. And I cannot be any more forceful about this. Because what I have seen and what I have heard over the past few years greatly disturbed me. I'm greatly disturbed by what I see and hear when it comes to God. By people sometimes that should know better. I could almost excuse it for some that don't want to know any better. But when I hear it from people who should know better, I get disturbed. You see, our God is a majestic God. In the passage that was read a few moments ago, Isaiah saw God sitting on a throne, lofty, exalted. His robe filled the earth, smoke, and when he spoke, when those seraphim spoke, everything shook. When Ezekiel saw a vision of God in Ezekiel chapter 1, he saw something. And he saw something that he could not describe. He tried to use words to describe something that could not be described. And though he tried everything, you notice the word like all the time through that first chapter. And it's Ezekiel trying to say, this is what I saw, but what I saw is not described in what I'm saying. It, Revelation chapter 4, you have Isaiah, or you have John, who was taken up into the heavens. And John saw God, Revelation 4, verses 1, he saw God, and he explains, and he says, I saw God sitting on a throne. God is a spirit being. He doesn't sit on a throne. But what John is trying to do is to describe something that, using words that you understand, to describe that which cannot be understood. God is an exalted God. He is a majestic God. And you cannot describe God. You can describe God that He's no longer God. He defies description. God is from everlasting to everlasting. We cannot comprehend that thought. No matter what we know, we cannot understand how something can be from everlasting to everlasting. Because when He says it's from everlasting to everlasting, that just totally destroys our thinking, because we believe that something has to have a beginning, something has to have an end, but God is from everlasting to everlasting. And it's impossible for us to come to terms with such an idea. Before the world was, God is. You recall the passage in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14. Moses sees the burning bush and he approaches that burning bush. And God said, don't come any closer. Take your shoes off, for the ground upon which you're standing is holy ground. And then he eventually has this conversation with God, and God tells him, I want you to go back to Egypt, lead my people out. And he said, who shall I say sent me? God said, I am that I am sent you. And God is saying, I am self-existing. I am from everlasting to everlasting. And in John chapter 8, Jesus is having a debate with the religious leaders. And John and Jesus, I'm just going to get down to verse 58, you read the whole text. But Jesus makes this statement, before Abraham was, I am. He took the words from Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, and applied them to himself. And the reason being is because Jesus was at that bush. He was at the bush. Before the world was, God is. And He is the creator of all. We marvel at what has been invented. We really do, don't we? There's some of us here that are old enough to remember when you picked up the receiver, you had a female voice on the other end that said, your number, please. Remember that? And they plugged you into the number. And then we really thought we arrived when we got the dial phone. Actually, we thought we arrived when we got a private line. But then we got the dial phone. And then from the dial phone, we got the push button phone. Remember those? Believe it or not, when my mom passed away, she still had a push button phone. She'd been renting it from the phone company for 40 years. And then, some 44 years ago, this guy steps out of his office, out on the street. He worked for Motorola. And he had in his hand a telephone. And he called, made a phone call. And he's talking to his friend. He said, "You don't know where I'm standing." He said, "Where are you standing?" He said, "I'm out on the sidewalk." "At a phone booth?" He said, "No." "Well, how in the world you call me?" He says, "I got a cell phone." At that time, it was called the brick. Because it was about this tall, about that thick, you know, and weighed a ton. And now look. They got it down to where you could just put it in your shirt pocket. Although, it seems like Apple wants to try to get phones big enough so they don't fit in your pockets anymore. But you see what you can do with those phones? You can take pictures with them. In fact, you know what Garmin is, don't you? You know that little thing in your car that allows you can put an address in and it takes you wherever you want to in the world? Well, guess what? You can do that with your phone now. Don't you marvel at that? The automobile, don't you just marvel at the way the car works? But you know, there's one thing all those inventors have in common. They all had to use stuff that was already made in some form or another. God spoke the world into existence. "Let there be light." And there was light. Let anybody try that. See how awesome that is? That's our God. And then we say, well, you say that God created everything. I believe in the Big Bang Theory. You know, Albert Einstein was smart enough to figure that out. He asked this question. And by the way, nobody's answered the question yet. He asked this question. He said, "So, where did that which went bang come from?" You see, the universe is not eternal. The universe is running down. God created our world. He created you. And isn't it awesome that all of us seated in here this morning have our own fingerprint? We have our own DNA. It's yours. It doesn't belong to anybody else. God created you. And that's an awesome thing to think about. God created you. No human could create as God created, so we bow before our Creator. He is holy. We read in Isaiah chapter 6 and Revelation chapter 4 where the seraphim saying, "Holy, holy, holy." God is a holy God. Worthy of our worship. Worthy of our allegiance. Worthy of all of our praise and glory. And sin is an offense to a holy God. Psalm 51, David talks about his sin. He said, "Against you and you only have I sinned." Genesis 3, we have Adam and Eve recognizing they've committed their sin. Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 5. Isaiah says, "Woe is me, for I am a ruin, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." God is holy. The word holy means sacred. Consecrated. Special. There are just some things that are sacred. God is sacred. I get nervous when I hear people telling jokes about God. I kind of want to just get out of the way. I don't want to hear it. God is sacred. He is holy. God is independent. Needs nothing to exist. He is not human. He is sovereign. God, totally independent, rules the world. He holds time and space together. And were He to withdraw His Word for just a millimeter of a second, the universe would collapse. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3. Our world, everything around us, would come to an end if God were to withdraw His Word for just less than a blink of an eye. God is mysterious. I'm not speaking of some mystic concept, but God is Himself a mystery. Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. God says, "My ways are not your ways, nor are my thoughts your thoughts, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." God's ways are a mystery. Evil exists. I wish it didn't. I hate it every time I see something on television where somebody does something to innocent people. I think of ISIS. But I also think of those parents who abuse their children. It's just evil. It's just evil. Suffering exists. I wish it didn't exist. I wish God would just take evil and wipe it off the face of the earth. He'd take suffering away from there. I wish that was, that's what I wish God would do. But He's not going to do that. You know what else is a mystery to me? The freedom of humanity to be able to make a decision as to whether he wants to follow God or not. We call it the human will. God's given humanity the freedom to exercise His will. They can make their own choices. God's ways, to me, are a mystery. I sit there and oftentimes I just shake my head. I don't understand it. In fact, I confess to you this morning, I just don't understand God. I don't. And when I was putting this lesson together, I'm thinking, who am I to talk about God in these ways? I don't know enough about God to be able to speak with Him. But I also know that in my prayer time, I think this is exactly what God told me to do. God's means of salvation is a mystery. Does it strike you at all mysterious that God would come to this world as a human being? Does that not make you just kind of shake your head and wonder about it? And God, who came to our world, went to a cross. Let me just say something here. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not. But we oftentimes think that when Jesus ascended back up to heaven, that he just assumed the role that he had before he came to this world. He didn't. Philippians 2 tells us that he emptied himself of all of his glory. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 tells us that he is now subservient to the Father. He gave up more than you can even begin to imagine to come to this world as a human being. And he goes to that cross. Do you remember those that were at the cross looking up at him and saying, "He saved others, but he can't save himself"? You ever stop to think how true that little phrase is? He couldn't come down off that cross. If Jesus had come down off that cross, your and my salvation would not have been paid for. So what those guys said, "He saved others, but he can't save them," it's true. He can't. Because God's plan would not let him. The cross was not well received in the first century world. 1 Corinthians 1:22-25 talks about how to the Jews the cross was a stumbling block. To the Greeks it was foolishness. Paul says, "For us who are being saved, it is the power of God and the wisdom of God, for the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men." God's ways are a mystery. His salvation is a mystery. His revelation is a mystery. There are some things that God does not tell us. He refuses to answer our curiosities. But being human, we want answers, don't we? We want to put everything in a nice little box. And so you got Job. Job is wanting to know why he's suffering. Why is he going through all of this? And God doesn't answer him. The prophet Habakkuk sees the army of the Babylonians coming, the sinful, idolatrous people. And they're coming to destroy God's people. And Habakkuk tells God, he said, "Why are you doing this? How could you do this?" And you got to love God's answer. He tells Habakkuk, "If I told you, you would not understand." God's revelation is a mystery. But God reveals Himself in the Scriptures. I encourage you never to think for God. If you want to know what God thinks about something, read your Bible. He'll answer it for you. God's infinitude is a mystery. And what I'm saying is that God is limitless. He has no limitations. I was out riding with a friend of mine one day, and he made this statement. His name is Mike. He made this statement. He said, "I know that God is real busy handling all the affairs of the world, and He absolutely has no time for what few things I've got that bother me, and I'm not going to bother Him with them." See what he did? He just created God in His image. You put limitations on God, then you've created a God that is not worth having. I refuse to bow the knee to a God who is limited. I refuse to bow the knee to a God that cannot reach out to every man, woman, and child, no matter when or where, when He needs to do that. God has no limitations. He is in the past, He is in the present, and He is in the future. God is merciful. We speak of God being a God of love and how true that is. And when I think about a merciful God, I think about the fact that God's mercy makes Him approachable. Remember the curtain that was between the most holy place and the holy place? And when Jesus died, God took and He ripped that curtain down. And He says, "You can come into My presence anytime." In fact, the Hebrew writer says, "Let us come boldly before the throne of grace that we might find grace and mercy to help in that time of need." God is approachable. We are sinful. But God tells us, "Come on into My presence." In fact, we are sinful, but He invites us to worship. Isn't it an awesome thing that when you came in here this morning for worship, you met God? I hope you did. Sometimes I'm a little bit concerned about many of our churches. More concerned about performance than the art of transcendence. Worship ought to take you into the presence of the Most Holy. Worship ought to take you right before the throne of grace. Worship needs to take you just exactly where John went. And when it does, your worship. God's mercy cannot be exhausted. And for the sinner and the believer, this is most comforting. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 4. Paul talks about how that we were dead in our trespasses and sin and so on and so forth. And then he opens up verse 4. He says, "But God, being rich in mercy because of the love that He has for us." God's mercy cannot be exhausted. God's grace is in abundance. And there is no time when we cannot seek His forgiveness. And I know that sometimes we may feel like God has every right to toss us overboard. And I think David may have even felt that way in Psalm 51. But Micah the prophet said, "What God is there like You who delights in forgiveness?" God is merciful. He's approachable. Cannot be exhausted, but I want to say this. God's mercy is not to be abused. God's mercy is not to be abused.
Remember, our perception of God is going to speak on how we live. And if you have a heart for God, and you have the right attitude about God, you never have to worry about abusing His grace. God is a majestic God. God is a mysterious God. Merciful God. What kind of a God are you searching for? Let me tell you this. This is what I want. I want a God who will intrude on my life. I want a God who refuses to accept my second best. I want a God who refuses to overlook my sin. I want a God who will expect more from me than what I am giving. I want a God who will not change with the cultural norms. And I want a God who will bless me not on the basis of my performance or my faith, but because He sees my needs. This is the God I want to know. And I hope someday I'll be able to speak the words of the psalmist as he spoke in Psalm 63. And of course, it's David. O God, You are my God. Earnestly I seek You. My soul thirsts for You. My body longs for You. In a dry and weary land where there is no water. I have seen You in the sanctuary and beheld Your power and Your glory. Because Your love is better than life, my lips will glorify You. I will praise You as long as I live, and in Your name I will lift up my hands. My soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. With singing lips, my mouth will praise You. On my bed I remember You. I think of You through the watches of the night. Because You are my help, I sing in the shadow of Your wings. My soul clings to You. Your right hand upholds me. I pray that someday I'll mature to that level. But all I can say now is that I am thankful that God accepts me for who I am, what I am, refuses to accept me where I am and pull me in to being something better, to be something better, to think something better. I want God to draw me nearer to Him. I want to ask you to stand as we sing this hymn. It is a prayer written by Fanny Crosby. A beautiful hymn, a beautiful prayer.